Hello, and welcome to another episode of I Never Thought It Would Happen. It's made in collaboration with the wonderful charity that is Simply Help Musicians. Joining me on I Never Thought It Would Happen is a young musician from Bristol. She's taken roots and blues music and given it a fresh look. Earlier this year, she released her third album, Shining in the Half-Light, which was met with great reception. So here she is. Please meet the wonderful Els Bailey. Hi, Els. Welcome to I Never Thought It Would Happen, which is a podcast for help musicians. Do you know much about them at all?
I'm looking at just applying for one of their grants, actually, at the moment for getting back to touring. So,
shall I put a word in for you?
Oh, please do.
Yeah, I just saw that this morning, the getting back to touring thing.
Like, for me, it's the cost of hotels have just, like, they've not gone up a huge amount, but they've gone up. You know, I get hotel rooms for all my band, and you're suddenly £100-200 more than you would have spent 2 years ago. And it's like, Yeah. Oh, it's just those little pinches.
Yeah, I know that experience, going on the road and having to pay for hotel rooms, and it gets more and more expensive as things move on, and thank God that help musicians are there to give you a hand.
Yeah, there are. It's amazing, and they're just fabulous that there are bodies that are able to help. So they're very grateful.
So with help musicians hopefully giving you backing to go on the road coming up with your touring, do you think that the government could have done a better job?
Well, you'll have to listen to the first track on my latest album. It's called Cheats and Liars. I wrote it with my friend Ash Tucker in between lockdown season one and lockdown season two, and the budget had just come out. So the October sort of 2020 budget had just come out, and it was at the time that I think they slashed the self-employed income to 30%.
Yes,
I know that didn't stick, but that's what they did. That's how they started. And I was listening to a Radio 4 show where they were talking to some MP, and they specifically said, so what about musicians? What about musicians who can't get out on the road because we might have been in between lockdowns, but venues were still shut? And he just said, they will just have to retrain. And I was just livid. I was so angry, because the arts were the thing that got people through.
Yeah.
The arts is how I stayed sane through those really horrific days in isolation. And I watched so many people connect with other people, you know, via Zooms, via Facebook Lives, you know, because artists just sat there, you know, entertainers, musicians, comedians, they just got in front of a screen, warts and all, without the band, without the lights, without the sound, and they connected with people. And that was so helpful to millions and millions of people. And then the government just went, nah, we're not going to help you. Go retrain. And us just seething. So Ash and I wrote Cheats and Liars, and it's one of my, I look at the lyrics and it's one of my favourite lyrical pieces that I've got, like, purely from a lyrics point of view. I really felt like I said, like we said, exactly what we were feeling. And I felt incredibly honoured because Janice Ian shared it.
Wow. Congratulations.
And I didn't even realize, and then someone popped a comment on my YouTube video for it and said, I'm here because Janice Ian has shared this song. And I was like, what? Sorry. So I went and had a look, and yeah, she'd sort of shared it because she felt like she really, really liked the lyrics. So.
Yeah, I mean, it's pretty obvious that this particular government don't give a toss about you and me. But
I don't think they give a toss about anybody.
Pretty much.
Apart from themselves.
Apart from themselves.
Yeah. I was only having this discussion earlier today.
Oh, really?
Listening to another Tory MP just sort of reciting what he has to get them through Partygate. And I was just like, are you joking? Like, yeah, and let Cheats and Liars be the anthem for you know, hopefully a new wave of people that actually care about people.
Yeah. Do you appreciate songs that are kind of politically driven, you know, like Bob Dylan or people like that?
I definitely do. Mm. I definitely do. I think it's a privilege to be where we are, but we have been sort of given a voice. Mm. And if you can use that for good and for change, I think that's really important.
Yeah, people like Kay Tempest, for instance, has an incredible platform to speak.
Yeah, Frank Turner.
Frank Turner and Dave is incredible, Stormzy.
Oh, gosh, Dave's amazing, I mean, absolutely amazing.
The lyrical language that those guys have is extraordinary.
Yeah, and they're really, really making a splash to a huge audience. I think it's great.
Yeah.
I love Dave.
Yeah, me too. When you were starting out, was music big to you when you were at school?
Yeah, it was. I was just right from the beginning, I think probably from the age of 3 when I joined nursery, that's kind of when I started getting into music, musical theatre. I always just felt like I wanted to be on the stage. And all through school, actually, I was really into musical theatre. I was either going to be musical theatre or just music, and I ended up on this path. But I don't know, a few different turns earlier back in the day, and I may have ended up on the stage doing theatre.
What was it about musical theatre that you found fascinating?
Just the fact that you can sing your way through life. Honestly, all of my band are like, Els, we hate musical theatre. Like, oh, it's just horrible. And I'm someone who just sings my way through life, and it's just always been something that I've just absolutely loved.
Is there a favourite stage play that you recognise and lean towards?
Oh, that's a really tricky one. I can't even think the play now, but there was one song that has just sort of stayed with me right from when I was like 6 or 7, and it was, I think it's called Nothing, like I have nothing and there is nothing. Yeah, it's all about actually not being able to find the way to improvise. And I performed it, I think when I was like 6 or 7, I just thought that was the coolest song ever. It may be because it also had a swear word in it, and I felt very, very old and mature that I could sing a swear word.
So you were a bit of a rebel then, you like to swear.
Oh, I've got a 1-year-old son now, so I'm definitely having to... Yeah, I'm having to sort of curb that because he's now mimicking everything. Mm. So, yeah, no more swearing for Els.
Has he taken all the furniture out of your room?
Well, this is a whole other story, actually.
we don't need to.
Yeah, back in September 2020, we started a house renovation. I left the house just before recording my last record, which was December 2020, and we were due back June 2020 with a 3-month-old. The house build went horrifically wrong, and where are we now? Almost May 2022, and I now have over a 1-year-old, but there is carpet in our bedroom. So this is, and he's in nursery at the moment. So at the moment, I'm traveling 45 minutes on a Tuesday and a Wednesday to get him to the nursery right by where we should be living. But I think in 3 weeks' time, we'll be moving in. So, but that's why I'm sat literally in an empty room with a door by the window, because the door now won't shut because the carpet's too thick. But that's a good reason for the door not to shut. So I'm very happy with that.
The door isn't even on the wall there, it's on the window. It's just
exactly. It's just balancing.
So when you were at school and you're in musical theatre, what sort of pop bands or bands were you listening to?
Well, I was a product of the 90s, so whilst at home I'd be listening to my dad's music, so the band, the Eagles, you know, old school blues, Chess Records kind of stuff. At school I'd be listening to the Spice Girls and the Backstreet Boys, so it's, you know, a very polar opposite musical education, but it was great. So I was always wanting to be Baby Spice, but I'm slightly more ginger, so I always ended up being Jerry.
But you lean more towards the blues than the Spice Girls.
Yeah, I think so. But I was actually in an indie band for 5 or 6 years. So sort of I started writing at the age of 13, and my brother was a guitarist as well. So we were in an indie band together. My cousin at one point was in the band as well. And it was only sort of in my early 20s when my brother actually took over my dad's business, left the band, and I went to uni because I thought, well, just in case, I'll get a degree in psychology, something totally different. So another life, I may have been a counsellor because that's what I was studying. And then it was just in my third year, and I just really got back into like listening to sort of old school roots music, and that's when my writing started to sort of lead more in that direction. But it still took me until I was about sort of 26, 27 to really sort of know what I wanted to sound like as an artist. I didn't quite get it for quite a long while, so yeah. I took my time.
So do you think all that studying helped you with your lyrics at all?
Gosh, I don't know. Maybe. I think I really found just psychology just absolutely intriguing. And I think I just learned quite a lot, maybe, about trying to understand all different sort of experiences and people and what makes people, you know, do things. And I think sort of understanding that has definitely helped and allows me often to sort of step back away from the situation and sort of take a breath and reflect, and all of that is something that I got from, maybe it was just from studying, but
particularly useful when you're traveling around with the band, I think.
Yeah. I also think noise cancelling headphones is also
useful.
Really essential.
I haven't tried that, but that's pretty cool. I like that. So when you started writing songs, what sort of lyrical content were you supplying?
I mean, when I was 13, it was pretty
pretty basic.
It was pretty basic. I still remember the first song.
What was it?
I ever wrote. It was like, you've got to be who you want to be, go where you want to go, you know, do what you want to do.
It was Spice Girls. Sort
of, yeah, it was, wasn't it? Exactly. Yeah, so maybe my lyrical content started more Spice Girls. Thankfully, I think it's made its way back to the roots. It was probably from my first album, and I spent a lot of time like listening to lots of different music. And when you're making your first record, you have as long as you want to make it, which is great. But I found a lot of inspiration through the people who'd done it before me. So one of my songs is called Howling Wolf, and that's written all about the Chess Records story and the artists on that label. And there's another one called Perfect Storm. It's written about Muscle Shoals and the Muscle Shoals story.
Wow, amazing.
And Swampers. And I just found all of it just absolutely intriguing. And I love sort of trying to paint a picture in a song about, you know, a situation like that. And then I remember I did a big tour of Europe, one of my first tours of Europe, actually came home and just, you know, a little bit tired because I was tour managing and, you know, doing everything that you do as an indie artist whilst also being on the stage as well. And got home exhausted, put on Netflix and watched Little Girl Blue, which is the documentary about Janis Joplin. And I got about two-thirds of the way in and I'd written loads of lyrics, and it's called Girl Who Owned the Blues. I paused it, went, sat at the piano, never finished Little Girl Blue. I've never finished the documentary, but out came this song, which is still a song that I play today. And, you know, the story of Janis Joplin and the pain and the tragedy that she went through, you know, all the way to the end. Like I was just sort of so heartbreakingly inspired by that.
It's lovely that you're kind of like a historian for a new audience. You're sort of bringing the past to the present, which I think is a great thing.
Yeah, I think so. And I think, you know, it helps. I do think that it's so important to continue to tell these stories, but to also really, you know, I'm really keen on trying to push blues and roots to a younger audience as well. I think that's so important because there's a lot of us who are out there. I mean, I'm not as young as I was, but, you know, I've been playing this music for 10 years and, you know, I started getting back into it when I was like 23, 24. And I was like, you know, we need to get 23-year-olds back in the audience listening to this kind of stuff.
Do you think that they're probably tuning in via social media and via Spotify and, you know, various downloading places. You know, that I find that, for instance, with our band, some of our audiences are quite young, and I wonder how they get to hear about us. And a lot of it is just by chance.
Yeah, I think streaming platforms, everything is a little bit by accident, isn't it? And you sort of stumble across little gems, and I'm definitely seeing, as my profile grows on these streaming platforms, that the audiences are coming in are younger, and I'm sure they are coming from streaming platforms and from festivals as well. But of course, we haven't had a good festival season for the last couple of years. So,
is this going to be a good festival season for you?
I hope so. I really hope so. It's looking good, and it's also, it's quite varied. I love a good varied festival season. So there'll be some nice knees up in a field kind of stuff, but there's also some sort of, you know, slightly less weather dependent as well, which is always good.
Yeah, absolutely. Are you a very disciplined writer? Must be.
I'd like to think so, but yeah. I haven't written a song now for probably since October 2020. But that is because I'd written so much early 2020. I was recording an album in December of 2020. I then had a baby, and then I started the album campaign. So there's not really been a huge amount of time for writing. However, I'm making a trip down to Pennard in May. So
I know, I'm looking forward to seeing you there.
So I'm going to have to sharpen the pencils, I think.
You will be sharpening pencils. Just for those people who are not aware what Pennard is, it's a songwriting week. Supported by the Help Musicians and the Buddy Holly Foundation, and it's going to be wonderful to see you in the flesh there, of course.
Yeah, I'm so excited, and just really looking forward to the space to write music again. Literally the day the album came out, I started writing lyrics again. I think I get so caught up in the album campaign, and I remember someone asked me, and it was all about songwriting, and I felt a little bit of a fraud sort of doing this interview, because I was like, gosh, I can't remember, I haven't written a song in a year. And one of the questions was like, how do you feel when new music sort of gets out there? I was thinking about it and, you know, reflecting on past album releases, and I think I get a fear, and then whilst everyone's listening to this new music that isn't at all new to you, I get this sort of fear of the unknown and what's next, and also excited anticipation as well. And then as soon as the album was out, I got that fear, I got that anticipation, and then I started writing lyrics again. So I was like, oh, cool. The next chapter starts.
And when you write, is there a specific place that you like to find your inspiration?
No, not really. I make sure I'm always on the hunt, I think, for inspiration. Like, I'm always looking, and often if you find it and then you don't write it down, it's kind of gone. I find that. And I find often just before you go to sleep, you get this sort of, you get that. And then if you don't wake yourself up, it's
annoying.
Gone. It's gone forever.
It's so annoying, isn't it?
It's so annoying.
I've had that recently, and I always think to myself, if it's there in the morning, then it was worth it.
Oh, that's good. So maybe all of my, you know, number one hits that I've written just before I've gone to sleep were never number one hits.
Never meant to be. What's the experience of co-writing like for you?
That's actually where I'm a lot more disciplined, I think. I think because, you know, there is someone else in the room and you've got someone to answer to a little bit as well. Like, you're both in there. I think I've kind of always done it because I've worked a lot with my brother when we were younger. Quite a lot of my first album were just ones that were sort of mainly written by me. But my last two records have almost all been co-writes because I just love getting in a room with someone and, you know, you can sit down and tell a story and find something totally different from that story that you never kind of thought was there. So I think having that, and like I said, having someone to sort of answer to is a good thing.
You must be good at sharing then.
I hope so. Yeah, I hope so. I'm trying to teach Jasper how to share at the moment. Ooh, I think that's it's a very important thing to do.
When you first got your record deal, what was that like?
I don't have a record deal.
Oh, you don't have a record deal?
No, I don't have a record deal. Yeah, so I actually, my latest album, Shining in the Half Light, it was released February 22. It was finished in April 21, but I had literally just given birth. But one of the other reasons, other than, you know, raising a child from the very early stages, was because we were actively looking to partner with a record company on this record. And on the day I started my rescheduled March 2020 tour, which was October 2021, I actually got offered a traditional record deal, which was exactly what I'd been looking for. And then just like that, I decided to self-release. whilst on tour with a six-month-old.
Oh my God.
And for me, you know, it was so important for this record to be chart eligible, and I have my own record company called Outlaw Music, and we aren't affiliated with the charts, so I kind of had to figure out like how to sell this album and also not to go through a third party, because on my last album I was one of the many artists that got burned by Pledge Music. So I had to figure all of that out whilst on tour, and it ended up with me building a new website just for this album that could plug into my distributors, and then every sale ended up being chart eligible. So the it went really well in the end, but it was very, very stressful few weeks trying to learn how to code whilst in the back of a tour bus.
My God, so you're not only living above the shop, you're running the shop.
Yeah, basically.
Wow, that's hard work. And the investment of time and money must be... Is that a stress at all?
It was hugely stressful. I must admit, as soon as the album came out, and I then ended up getting COVID, and then just like back-to-back viruses ever since that. But... yeah, I think I was just so wound up in stress and anticipation and hoping that everything goes right, because I've released all my other albums, but this was just on such a much bigger scale, which is amazing, which is exactly what you want as an artist, but just the economies of scale of that. And I remember being at Rough Trade Records in Bristol, which is my hometown. We literally just found out that the album was number 11 in the midweek charts, and my distributors and fulfillment house were saying, HMV have sold out of stock, we need more stock. And I was just like, I've now got to figure out how to get a load more stock to Dartford. I'm heading to Leeds and I'm about to go on stage. And it was just absolutely nuts. And I was like, oh my gosh, I'm not in any kind of headspace for this. But yeah.
Yeah, I don't know if I could do that. I mean, I've been considering recording a record recently, and, you know, it's just... A, I don't know if I can afford it, and B, I'm not sure who's going to listen to it. And C, I just don't know whether I've got the headspace for it all, because it is such a task, really, to put a record out these days.
Yeah, it really is, especially with physical product and making sure everything goes to the right places, and you just end up doing logistics, really. The whole week of release was just logistics.
Yeah, wow. And then you've got the musicians to pay and studios, or do you have your own place where you cut records?
No, I used Middle Farm Studios in Devon for this album.
That sounds great. What's that like?
Yeah. Oh my gosh, it's such a beautiful, really amazing, stunning like drum sound. The drum sound was just incredible. It's really rootsy, lots of vintage gear. We actually recorded to tape, which was definitely not what I'd planned. I remember when I was chatting with the producer, Dan Weller, and he said, oh, let's go to Middle Farm, and oh, we could record to tape. And I was like, I think we've got enough things to worry about, because we had, you know, we were recording in COVID times, and I was 6.5 months pregnant, so there was just a lot of other things. I was like, yeah, no, we won't do it to tape. And then when we got in, yep, we were recording to tape. I was like, okay, fine, we'll do it on one song and see how it goes. And yeah, it went really well, and I definitely go back to that studio. Pete, who runs it, is just brilliant and so into all of his gear and sounds, and, you know, really getting like vintage rootsy sounds as well, which is exactly what I wanted. And the room was such a great space. We were all able to basically be in the same room and record, which is what I wanted as well. It's how I've always made my albums. So
In every episode of I Never Thought It Would Happen, we hear from an artist who's benefited directly from Help Musicians and learn a little about their experiences and the support the charity provides.
My name is Jonjan Kavlakolu and I'm a solo instrumental guitarist specializing in flamenco funk fusion on acoustic guitar. It was Carlos Santana that got me into the guitar. The Abraxas album on my mum's car stereo. My ears had never heard that searing guitar sound followed by a Latin percussion orchestra in the background. And that's very much my route into music and route into guitar. Similarly, I remember being absolutely obsessed with Chic and also with Bob Marley's Exodus. I can't not mention when talking about highlights that I've had the honour of playing in Jimi Hendrix's former apartment in London. An amazing kind of honour for a guitarist like myself who was massively influenced by Hendrix, as is any other electric guitarist, whether they know it or not probably. In the instance, I definitely felt something and I felt kind of like I was in a revered place as a guitarist. The idea of live streaming, if you talked to me about that pre-pandemic, I would have said I hate it and you won't be able to have a connection with the audience. My mind changed over quite a short period of time. Some of the funds from Help Musicians went directly into purchasing the gear required for me to stream and for me to earn my money. However, there is a unique selling point to streaming that I had no idea about, that I didn't realise would be such a unique aspect, which is if I've got a chat box feedback from the audience in real time, I can see very candidly what they like about each section that I'm playing, let's say. Someone will say, oh, I love this bit, or wow, how is he doing that? And I'd be able to see that on screen. And you can react to that feedback and maybe embellish that part if people are enjoying it. And I found that so unique. It can be even more intimate in some ways than physical performance. The streaming has become another platform, another gig type. And one of my biggest clients is Google. And that would never have been able to be the case if I wasn't streaming it. They were streamed performances to Google staff internationally all around the world. One resounding thing that I found was that so many musician friends, and after talking with some of the staff at Help Musicians, nearly everyone that was applying kind of said, I want these funds, this support to go to someone who needs it more. If you're already kind of in a need situation, then you are the person who needs that, and there's no guilt in that, and that there shouldn't be any kind of negativity with that. Whether it's financial or whether it's mental health support or whether it's just someone to talk to unload about these things, I would massively recommend contacting Help Musicians. To all musicians, it's been an extremely tough time and I hope you're all doing okay in whatever way that is. I really feel like us musicians have banded together through this, and I hope that continues because that's been beautiful to see.
To discover more about the amazing work that Help Musicians do, then look out for them on all social media platforms or go to their website at helpmusicians.org. So how many musicians do you have around you?
So I've got four who tour sort of with me 90% of the time. Joe Wilkins on guitar, Matthew Jones on drums, Matthew Ware on bass, and Johnny Henderson on the Hammond organ. So that's the sort of key lineup. And then for this latest album, the first thing I knew that I wanted, as soon as Road I Call Home, my second album, came out, I knew that this next album needed to have gospel-inspired backing vocals. Mm. So I didn't quite know how that was going to happen, especially as we recorded it in COVID times, and you know, it wasn't really the done thing to sing in a room with people. But actually Matthew Ware, my bassist, works with an incredible artist called Izzo Fitzroy, and she said, oh, I'll do all the BVs and sort of arrange all the BVs. And she got in two of the girls that sing with her as well, so Jade Elliott and Cilla Mosley. And so that's been the core sound for this record, and we got to play out live as an 8-piece as well, so that was amazing.
You are an inspiration. When people who come to my songwriting workshops, they ask me, well, you know, how can I get a record deal? And I would say to them, you don't have to.
I think I'm definitely, you know, I'm never going to say never, because that was a lot of work releasing this album, and I definitely think I'd really like to partner with someone in some way now, I think. But it's scary because I'm I'm a control freak and I've done this
my
own way and, you know, made it up as I've gone along. But at least, you know, the mistakes have been mine.
Yeah, the mistakes are yours, but it's great joy to have your record out, I'd imagine, and have the control that you're looking for, I guess.
Yeah, it really, really is. It really is.
It means you can record the songs that you love rather than what a record company would like you to do.
Yes, that is definitely true.
And when you're doing shows, do you have a merch stand that you hang out at?
Yes, I do. Yeah, so I love all different merch stuff. So I always take that and always go out and see people at the end of the show as well. Which I think I started, obviously, sort of October 21, I was very, very nervous about going out, especially at the beginning of the tour when you've got 18 dates to make it through. But yeah, we all made it through unscathed. And then I was like, fine, I'm immune to COVID. And then March came along and I was like, oh yeah, I'm not immune to COVID. But I did make it through every single date without getting it. So that was great.
And what sort of venues are you now playing?
So my last tour, we did the Sage 2 in Gateshead.
A beautiful venue.
Oh, yeah.
The sound is extraordinary.
Oh, yeah. The sound is amazing. And my friend Demi Mariner, who's a really, really incredible
songwriter.
Oh, I know
Demi. She's incredible.
Oh,
yeah.
I love Demi. So she was on tour with me at the time, and that was our last gig. And Peter, who's my tour manager, good friends with Demi as well, he'd sort of heard her singing along to every track, like, you know, as I was singing it. He was like, Els, get Demi to sing with you. Mm. And I was like, okay, fine. So at the Sage 2, Demi came and did all the BVs because she just learnt them all because she'd been at all the shows. And she's now actually coming and doing BVs on quite a lot of the festival dates as well.
What sort of festivals are you penned to do?
A real mixture. So I've got some blues, rhythm and rock festivals, one in Lincoln, Bilston. I am playing Cambridge Folk Fest.
Oh, great.
Cheltenham Jazz Fest.
That's a good one, yeah. Have you tipped your toe into America?
I have, yeah. I actually made Wildfire and Rodeo Call Home over there. So my first two records were made in America. I've done a few dates out in Nashville, but they've always kind of coincided with either songwriting retreats. Mm. I've never done a sort of tour of America. And, I'm going to have to do it at some point. But at the moment, just the terrifying cost of COVID and being an indie musician, you know, it's I'm fronting everything, and to get to the airport and then test positive or something would just be so, you know, that's the reality that we're living in at the moment. So until, you know, I don't even know when that is.
No.
But, you know, hopefully soon it will be a little bit more steady and, you know, I can make the jump across the pond. I think I'm ready to go back. I've not been to Nashville since 2019 and I'd love to head back now.
Good time. Who was the first live artist that you saw and what impression did that make upon you?
So I can't really remember the first live artist, purely because my parents always took me to shows. So from a very early age, I was just surrounded by live music. But I do remember the first gig that I went to without my parents. And that was at the Fleece and Firkin in Bristol.
Bristol.
It's now just called the Fleece. And I was watching a band called Rooster, who was sort of a pop rock band. And I, oh my gosh. I just really, really fancied the lead singer. I was also 17 and it was an over 18 gig. So this is the truth now coming out. I borrowed Victoria Clewin, who's a jazz singer. She's a brilliant jazz singer. I borrowed her fake ID just in case. I never got ID'd, but I was like, I do not want to not get into this show.
Wow.
So, Vicky, thank you very much. But yeah, made it. And then the guitarist actually ended up being a founding member of the Temperance Movement, who are one of my favourite rock bands on the scene. They've now split up, but their three albums that they make I absolutely love. And the record deal that I got offered was actually from their old label as well.
Oh, I see.
So, yeah, it sort of all goes in circles, doesn't it?
Yeah. And what was the first record that you bought?
Spice Girls, Wannabe.
No, really.
This interview was going
proper
so
record,
well, wasn't it?
Proper record, come on. No, I'm
oh
joking.
Oh, gosh. Proper record.
Something that you played and you went, you know what, this is where I want to be.
Oh, so it's not actually, it wasn't where I wanted to be, but I was sort of 8 or 9 and I just absolutely loved it. It was Bat Out of Hell, Meatloaf.
Which so, bridges the gap between rock and musical theatre.
The band and the Spice Girls. Yeah. No, I did. Yeah, exactly. Yeah. I loved that sort of huge, huge production, and you know, as a 9-year-old, I just found it just mind blowing. So yeah.
I mean, he was a big cuddly kind of guy, wasn't he? He had an extraordinary voice, and the energy that he had was amazing.
Yeah.
I mean, I never really liked what he did, but I thought it was an incredible feast.
Yes, yeah, it was definitely that huge, huge kind of sound that kind of matched, I don't know, who he was, I guess.
Do you ever think that maybe writing a stage play or a musical about somebody that you've looked into in the past might be something that you would spend some time doing?
I've never even thought about that till now, but actually, maybe we'll have to do it.
Yeah.
You've just come up with a great idea.
Because it seems to me that a lot of people like you and me, I guess, are, you know, exhausted doing what we do. But in the future, there's a possibility of writing something for the stage, because as our audiences get older, our audiences like that kind of evening out, a box of Maltesers and an ice cream.
Ice cream
and watching people sing and dance and be very smiley and a story being told on the stage.
I wonder who it'd be, who to write the story about. I mean, I do find Janis Joplin's story just absolutely intriguing.
Yeah, that's a heavy, heavy.
That is, that's not a smiley
story.
One though, is it? That's not a smiley
no,
story,
well,
is
I
it?
I don't know the story well enough, but I would imagine it's quite
probably
hard.
Probably not, no. Okay, maybe something more happy.
Also, getting someone to sing like her all night long would be a bit of a thing.
All night long, every night.
And a
matinee performance as well. That's a tough gig, isn't it?
Yeah. So with all of your writing and all of your singing, and you've got this family life that you've got to look after too. So how do you divide your time? You must have a husband that really looks after you.
Yeah, I've got... an incredible husband. He runs his own business, so he can be sort of reasonably flexible with, you know, sort of taking time off as well. And very, very grateful to grandparents as well. I've got, you know, and we've been living with my mum and dad for the last 18 months.
Yikes.
So they, yeah, but they've been incredible. And when I went on tour back in autumn, they had Jasper so much, so that was really, really, really helpful. Nick, my husband, works with his mum as well, so it's a bit of a family affair.
That's
we've got family
amazing.
Mm. Yeah, we've got, you know, just incredible family. And I think often I've found that a lot of people have got in touch with me, you know, if they've had a kid or if they're looking to have kids, they've sort of said, like, how do you do it? And honestly, like, I've done it because I've had so much support around me, and my parents have helped whenever they could. And I was just very much like, we're going to get as many people to help, because that's the only way that I can get back to work and sort of do this.
That's amazing. So the band are a kind of an extension of your family, I hope.
Yeah, 100%. I mean, Joe and I, we've been performing together since 2014, literally since the days of sleeping on pub floors.
Ooh.
To then like drive 17 hours to Germany to play, you know, a few shows. Like he's been there right right from the very, very early days. So very much just part of the family.
And do you have an agent who gets you these shows, or are you busy doing it as well?
Oh, my goodness, no. Thankfully, agent was like the first thing I relinquished. It took until, I think, the end of 2017 before I actually got an agent. And I now work with Beth Morton from UTA, and she's just brilliant. So the idea of getting gigs makes me shiver, not in a good way. And also, imagine, like, the last 2 years, I think the agents have had such a bad agents and promoters, and oh gosh, just the constant rescheduling is
particularly in the States, actually, where even if you wanted to go on tour over there, you couldn't because all the theatres are so booked up from last year and the year before. It's crazy.
It's absolutely crazy. I felt so privileged that I was able to be on tour last year, that I managed a window. You know, we literally just got off the tour as Omicron hit. So I just felt such a privilege that I was able to get out and play, because I knew so many artists they couldn't get the space, they couldn't get the show, you know, because it was booked up for the, you know, next year. So
in your darkest moments, if you have darkest moments, who do you lean on?
Oh, that's a tricky one. I love the High Women. So I don't know if you've heard the album, but that for me, I heard it in 2019, and it's a gem of a record. It's written by women for women, but in a way that doesn't isolate, you know, anyone else listening. And I just listened to that record because there's definitely going to be a song about how I'm feeling at that time, because they've just written about this broad spectrum of what it is and the different stages that you go through as a woman. So
who was responsible for writing that?
So Brandy Carlile.
Oh, there you go. Yeah.
And actually, to be honest, who do I lean on? Brandy Carlile. I listened to her so much on that last tour. I wasn't in a dark place at all, but I just, every time I go in the tour bus, I just go down Brandy Carlile hole, just sort of all through different records. But yeah, Brandy Carlile, Maureen Morris, Natalie Hemby and Amanda Shires, they are the High Women. And then Yola features as well.
Wow, so amazing.
Yeah, it's just really incredible. It's a beautiful, beautiful album produced by Dave Cobb. And I think it's Jason Isbell's band.
Okay.
But, mm-hmm. Yeah, so just amazing.
When you come off stage at night, do you think to yourself, God, I'm so lucky. What a great job I've got.
Yeah. 100%, because it just is. I'm also at the time usually looking for chocolate as well. And then I think, yeah, what a great job I have that at the end of the night I get to eat chocolate.
You get a Twix.
Yeah, it is. Isn't it a beautiful life? It's really hard. Like, I do. Yeah. It's exhausting and really sort of takes its toll, but it is a privilege, and I feel very, very grateful that I'm able to do this, and you know that my fans have sort of stuck with me right from the word go, and it's just grown. So I think that's, yeah, I feel very lucky.
Yeah, it's a privilege to go on stage. It's a great job, but you've studied for 3 years for counselling.
Yeah.
So you do have something to go back to if you wanted to.
Yeah, I do. I think I've still got all my, in the sort of, you know, hunt to find another pair of ripped jeans, because everything we have is in storage. So I haven't really seen any of my pre-pregnancy clothes for 2 years now. But in the hunt to find some, you know, alternative ripped jeans, I found all of my dissertation and old psychology books. So I might have to refresh my memory, I think.
Where did you study that, by the way?
In UWE in Bristol. So I've not left. I've not really left Bristol other than to tour. I love it here.
So Bristol is home.
Bristol is home, yeah.
That's great. Yeah,
it's a great place.
Well, thanks so much for your time. You've been wonderful, huge inspiration for people that are going to be listening to this podcast for Help Musicians. So thank you so much for your time, and we'll see you in a few weeks' time.
Oh, my absolute pleasure. Yeah, looking forward to meeting you in the flesh. Thank you so much for having me.
Okay, thank you. What a ball of energy she is. Fantastic. What an inspiration to all musicians. You know, she knows what she wants and she knows how to get the job done. So we have so much in common, not least that we think our close-knit band are very much a family. But unlike Els, I've never tried to learn computer coding or tried to build my own website while being on a noisy tour bus. Thank you, Els. That's really brightened up my day. To find out more about the wonderful work Help Musicians do, have a look at their website for loads more information. And please subscribe to this podcast. Thank you once again for listening. Please keep coming back. I Never Thought It Would Happen is a Gimme Sugar production for Help Musicians.